Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome back to Not Another Mummy Podcast with me, Alison Perry. In both of my pregnancies, I've suffered from morning sickness, but I can't even imagine what it must be like to suffer from hyperemesis gravidarum, extreme morning sickness. My guest today, Rhea Clark, does. She suffered from HG during her pregnancy 2 years ago and says that her experience has had a very lasting effect on her. Rhea is a doctor specialising in women's health, working in obstetrics and gynaecology. And she's on Instagram as Dr. Mummy, talking about everything from health to women's issues to racial issues. Here's what she had to say to me. So I'm here with Rhea. Welcome, Rhea, to the podcast.
Hi.
Hello. So you're a doctor in women's health.
I am indeed.
Tell me a little bit about your job and tell me a little bit why you decided that was the career for you.
Okay, so my job involves looking after women during the lifetime of reproductive health and before and after. So that involves everything from something like problems that can happen when people are children related to reproductive organs, as women get older, problems with periods, things like fertility. People mostly associate it with pregnancy.
Yeah.
But there's a whole scope of things outside of pregnancy that we deal with. Things like gynecological cancer, so cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial, problems associated with the menopause.
That sounds huge. Like, yeah. A massive scope of stuff that you must be an expert on.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't go so far as to say expert. I'm working towards it.
Yeah, yeah. So are you a junior doctor or are you, what's your actual job title?
So it's, I am a junior doctor. The title of junior doctor is really misleading because it basically means anybody that isn't a consultant.
Right.
So I've been a doctor for almost 8 years.
So it's not like, oh, I'm the intern.
Yeah.
It's like you've been doing it for 8 years. You know your stuff, you're experienced.
I'm experienced enough. I'm definitely getting there. But yeah, so someone who's just fresh out of medical school and someone who's almost a consultant are both called junior doctors.
That's really misleading, isn't it?
There are smaller terms that are used sort of colloquially. And so that would be registrar, which is the grade below consultant. Okay. And I'm sort of a baby registrar. So just at the beginning of being a registrar.
Okay.
But I think it's good to be upfront about where you are in your experience, especially on social media.
Yeah, yeah, of course. So are you based in a hospital? Do you have every day, do you have different people who have been referred to you or to your team? How does it work in terms of your day-to-day workload?
Yeah, so my specialty is mainly hospital-based, and it's very varied. So, for example, yesterday I was on call on labour ward, so that means looking after women during labour who may need the help of an obstetrician as opposed to those who are midwife-led.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow in the morning I am doing gynecological surgery with one of the consultants, and then in the afternoon I'm doing antenatal clinic with a different consultant. So it's really, really varied.
That must be brilliant that it is so varied and that, you know, you just mustn't ever get bored.
No, it's really hard to get bored. I think you know you're in the right specialty if you can look at a majority of the things and go, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I can learn something there.
That's so nice. And I guess you probably are always learning. You're always...
You have to be. If you're not learning, then you need to get out. I think the older I get and the more I look at senior colleagues, the more I realise that we're all still learning. And watching them talk to other colleagues and go, actually, I wasn't sure what to do with that case is really refreshing.
Yeah, it must be. So as well as that, you've got a two-year-old son?
I do. He's 2.5.
2.5. How would you describe family life? I mean, it must be, I always feel really bad for asking mums, how do you juggle your job and being a mum? Because it sounds quite patronising, but it's actually, it can be a struggle to keep those balls in the air and to, you know, keep everything going smoothly.
Yeah, it is. I love having a family. It's a great balance to having a really intense job. That said, I couldn't do it without the support of my family, or I could, but it would be a lot harder. I'm lucky that my husband is fantastic. And it's a balance talking about this too much, because I feel like he's an equal parent and he does his job in that he looks after our son when I'm at work, in a way that probably some other dads don't, in that if I'm on nights, if my son's up all night, then he just has to deal with it, because he can't call me and say, I don't know what to do, because I can't talk him through that. He just has to get on with it. So it takes a lot of partnership. And I'm very lucky that I have someone that just takes that on the chin and doesn't expect a reward for doing it.
Yeah.
I find it a struggle. I'm quite honest about the fact that I do find it really difficult, and that the things I'm able to do because of sacrifices that I or someone else in my family has to make. But it's a good balance.
And how do you find social media kind of, what kind of part does it play? Because I follow you on Instagram, and I feel like you're just, you're very, you seem very much about the captions, and it's almost like, I feel like it's little mini blog posts that you write, and you cover, you sort of talk so eloquently about so many different subjects, whether it's your family life or whether it's, work things or, issues, like women's issues, like so many different things. So how do you find that? Is that a release for you? Is it something that you rely on, to kind of, have almost like a sort of creative element to your life?
I've always liked writing. I like it as a creative outlet. I've thought about having a blog, but I worry that I'd get sucked into producing content for content's sake rather than it being spontaneous and just writing about whatever comes into my head, which is very much what my feed is. It's a complete mishmash of things I come across, things I think about.
I think that's the best way, though. I mean, and I think that even if you blog, that's the best way to blog. I mean, I have got a blog, and quite often people say to me, oh, so, do you blog every day, or do you do, X number of posts a week? And I'm like, no, I blog when I want to. I blog when I feel like, oh, I've got this thing that I really want to talk about, that's when you produce something really good. And it's the same on Instagram, that when you absolutely have that urge of, I want to communicate this, even if it's something silly, like a little something that that your son has done, I guess, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's that balance. Like, some of the things I write are quite deep and quite introspective, especially if it's about something sensitive like race or about sensitive medical topics. But it's also about the frivolous things. It's about, negotiating with my son about having a nap, because that is real life. Yeah. And it's nice for me to have somewhere where I can share those things. It originally started as a secret account when I first got pregnant, and I was going to post about me doing yoga and like being this yummy mummy who did all these amazing things.
Oh, really?
And that just didn't happen. And it kind of evolved from there. But it was a place where I could talk about how happy I was about being pregnant without people going, oh, she's talking about being pregnant again.
That's a funny thing, though, isn't it? That so many of us go through, I think, when you either become pregnant or become a mum, you don't want to be that bore who's always, like that baby bore.
Yeah,
or just,
absolutely.
And then I think you get to that point where you think, actually, I'm just going to talk about it because it's pretty cool and I'm all right with that.
Yeah, I was thinking about that on the way here, about going, I just really, really like being a mum and having a son. And to say that sometimes feels a bit nauseating, I guess. But I guess it's nice to move beyond the culture where we're just complaining about things all the time and not just saying, okay, parenting's really hard, but I really like
it. That's okay, isn't it? It's really interesting, actually, because I've got an 8-year-old, and when she was a baby, I found it really hard, and I had PND but didn't realize it. It was never diagnosed, but it was only when she was 18 months I looked back and thought, oh my goodness, I definitely had PND and I'm coming out of it now. But now I've got 6-month-old babies, twins, and I'm like, oh my goodness, like I'm only now almost like seeing what everyone else can see in terms of having a baby and the joy that it can bring. And
exactly,
you know, 8 years into being a mum and I'm still learning and I'm still realizing that actually there is joy to be had in this, and it doesn't have to be all, you know, a struggle and hard and oh, you know, like complaining about it all the time, and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that I saw you writing about on your Instagram recently, which really interested me, was you talking about the death rates with Black women during childbirth versus white women.
Yeah.
And you were quoted on BBC News talking about this, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the research and what's come out just recently.
So there's an annual report called the Embrace Report that looks at perinatal mortality. And perinatal mortality means deaths and, well, it looks at morbidity as well, but basically deaths that occur during pregnancy and for the first year afterwards. And the reason
it does, so it's pregnancy
that,
in the first year.
Absolutely.
So it's not just during childbirth.
Not just, no.
Right.
And it's trying to identify causes, any trends that we as medical professionals can work towards to try and reduce those awful outcomes. There are some things that are identified that aren't related to factors like race. For example, something called postpartum hemorrhage, so bleeding a lot after you have a baby, is associated with bad outcomes. So recognising that, increasing training for staff, making people more aware of that is a good thing. It's something that has emerged, and it's not a new thing. This hasn't suddenly come out of nowhere just because people have picked up on it this year.
Yeah.
But yes, the statistic is that in the UK, Black women are 5 times more likely to die during that period than white women, and Asian women are twice as likely to die.
Which is terrifying, isn't it?
It's absolutely terrifying, yeah. It's really scary. And yes, the total numbers are small, and so I think it's really important to highlight that. We don't want to scare people unnecessarily, but anybody dying at 5 times the rate of someone else deserves to have that looked into and for the question to be widened and asked, why is that happening?
And how much of that is medical factors, and how much of it do you think is racial bias?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, I think, because what we know is that there are biological factors that Black women and Asian women are more vulnerable to.
So what kind of things that are they more likely to suffer from?
So a really good example is gestational diabetes.
Right.
So when you go for your booking appointment in early pregnancy, the midwife will ask you a series of questions to help stratify your risk of different things. And if you come from a group that's at increased risk, for example, if you have someone in your close family who's had gestational diabetes, if you're high BMI, and if you're Black or Asian, there are other factors as well, but you will be offered a screen to test for gestational diabetes. Now, that's not offered to everybody because we know there are differing levels of risk. So that is a biological factor that we know affects people disproportionately.
Okay.
What we don't know is how much racial bias is involved in the high death rates. But I think it's really naive to not consider it.
Of course.
Which is what my point has been and why other people have been vocal about it. We know in the US there are lots of examples of the bias in healthcare. And even if they stratify for things like BMI and income, Black women are still more likely to die.
Yeah. So what can be done? What needs to happen? Is it a case of asking the question, why is this happening? And speaking to the health professionals involved and finding out more? Or what is it? How can we stop this from happening?
I think that's a start. I think we need to be talking about it, which is great. I'm here. We're talking about it. Listening. So talking is important. Listening is even more important. Listening to Black women and hearing what they're saying and not discounting it and going, well, you know, it's also because of this, and well, you are poor and you do live in a council flat. Yes, that way may well be true, but if someone's telling you that they were told something that they can relate to their experience of being Black or Asian, we need to take that on board. We need to think about cultural competency from very early on. So in medical school, and I know that there are some medical schools that look at things like unconscious bias, which we all have.
Yeah, of course.
Everybody has that. It's naive to expect us not to,
yeah.
But to think about how that affects us as individuals. How does it affect us as institutional systems, and what impact is that having on the women that we look after?
It's tricky though, isn't it? Because with listening to, you know, to people and asking these questions, there's a lot of discomfort involved with that, which is why it's not happening, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because people feel awkward. And when you talk about things like privilege, when you talk about racial bias, people who think, I'm a good person, I care about people, I work really hard in my job, I'm not racist. Because racism is someone shouting in the street, someone calling you a horrible name.
Yeah.
It's understanding the scope of racial bias and things like microaggressions mm-hmm. and how subtle it can be, and how people who experience that every day can feel when that happens. And you may only see it as an off the risk comment, but if that happens all the time and it makes you disengage from a service, then no one shouted at you, no one's called you an offensive word. But then if you're not getting the healthcare that you need, you might be more likely to have a bad outcome.
Yeah.
So it's really opening up the conversation. And yes, people will feel uncomfortable, but women are dying. So people just need to get over that.
And this is nothing new. This is just that this research has come out for the first time in the UK. Is that right?
Well, this report is released annually. And thinking about the report the year before, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but they weren't that dissimilar.
Right. Why is it only now being picked up on then? Is it just because it has happened to be picked up in the news and it's kind of had a bit of a snowball effect?
I think people were talking about it before, but I think what has changed is the use of things like social media and people speaking out. I hesitate to say that celebrities talking about more things has more gravitas, but if someone like Beyonce, if someone like Serena Williams speaks out about their experience and says, look, I am a black woman with money, with high profile, and I was still treated differently because I feel because of my race,
yeah,
then that makes people sit up and go, but Beyonce,
yeah,
I mean, have you seen Netflix? That happened to her.
Yeah.
So whilst it's sometimes frustrating that it takes something like that for people to pay attention, if people are paying attention, then good, let's change things while people are listening, because when people forget about this next week, people will still be dying.
Well, I've heard people saying quite a few times recently is that, you know, diversity is trendy right now. It's you know, it's you know, companies or you know media, TV shows, it's all about, you know, being seen to be inclusive. And that is kind of worrying if that is the case, because actually it needs to be a trend that only increases and only builds momentum. It shouldn't be something that this week we're talking about it and next week we're back to the way we were.
Yeah, we have to be careful of tokenism. And so if there's a bandwagon that people want to jump on in order to seem to appear woke,
yeah,
then that's not going to help anyone. And I think that's why black and Asian women need to be involved in driving the change forward, because they will unfortunately be invested in it in a way that passers-by aren't. So I think we need to be careful of people about what people's motivations are. But this is a long-term thing. This is bigger than social media. While social media is helping bring about change, if Instagram explodes tomorrow and it doesn't exist, I mean, I'll be annoyed all my photos have gone.
I know.
But the issues will still be there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, when you were pregnant 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago.
3 years ago,
Three years ago, you suffered from, and I'm going to mispronounce this, I'm sure, hyperemesis gravidarum.
I did indeed, and you said it correctly.
I feel like it sounds like a Harry Potter spell. Hyperemesis gravidarum.
If only there was a spell that undid it.
Oh, no, I can imagine. Well, you know, I can only imagine. Tell me what it was like, because some people describe it as being like bad morning sickness, but is that almost like an insult?
I don't know what bad morning sickness is like, because I've only been pregnant once, but I don't feel like that comes close. It's really hard to describe it to people who have never been there. But if you've ever been nauseous, if you've ever had food poisoning and you think about that level of despair, it's not just the nausea or the vomiting. It's the impact on your mental and physical health as well. The days I used to spend lying on the bathroom floor or having a plate next to me in the bathroom because there was no point moving. And my husband used to carry me up and down the stairs for a while because I couldn't walk.
You're kidding.
The long-term impact for lots of women. So lots of women suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder because of hyperemesis and its impact. If you look at the gaps between children of women that have hyperemesis, they quite often have a big gap because they either can't bear to go through it again or the logistics that you have to put in place before considering having another child, knowing what having one has done, are such that it has the consequences beyond just the pregnancy. But it was absolutely awful.
And how long did it go on for you? How many weeks or months?
So it started when I was 8 weeks, which is slightly later than most women. They usually get it a bit earlier. And it lasted, it wasn't as severe all the way through, but I was off work until I was around 17 weeks.
Wow, okay. So you just could not work through it? It wasn't feasible for you to get through a day of work?
No, I just couldn't function. I didn't get dressed, I couldn't wash, I didn't eat. I left the house to go to the GP, to go to the hospital. And other than that, I just didn't move. I couldn't function.
When you describe it like that, you can kind of understand why there are a certain percentage of women who have to terminate their pregnancy because of this.
Yeah. I was very fortunate not to be in that position, but I've met women in that position. I hold no judgment towards them whatsoever. I think that there is a huge problem with recognising how serious hyperemesis can be. Women used to die of hyperemesis before we were able to give fluids into women's veins. And I no woman has a termination lightly, whatever the reason, but these terminations are often wanted pregnancies. Yeah. And so to have to deal with that as a treatment, which is what women are doing it for, as a therapeutic way to stop how bad this feels, it's awful.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to the point where you were admitted and had to have intravenous fluids or...?
Yeah, so I was admitted when I was 8 weeks. I'm one of the few people that is allergic. Well, allergic's the wrong word. That has a reaction to most anti-sickness medications.
Oh, no.
Which means I can't take most of them. Which, sod's law, that is exactly the sort of thing that would happen to me.
Oh, that is just the worst.
So there was one that I could try, a drug called ondansetron, which is very difficult to get because of a preconception. It's really expensive and it's not, but it means it's really hard to get hold of. I had to beg for it.
Right.
And that didn't work.
Do you think that being a doctor helped you because you were able to have those sort of conversations with a certain level of knowledge?
I think it helped up to a point, but I don't think I necessarily got better care. I actually found some of my care from colleagues quite disappointing.
Really?
So I can only imagine what it's like for women that can't advocate for themselves and maybe don't have insight into what the treatment options are.
Do you think that's because of workload? I mean, I'm one of those people that when I'm in a hospital and I'm feeling a little bit ignored, or I'm feeling, you know, like someone's forgotten to do the rounds or forgotten to give me my pain medication or whatever it is, I'm very forgiving because I always think they're overstretched, you know, they're understaffed, they're doing their best. Do you think that your experience there was because of that, or do you think that there were other factors at play?
We are overstretched, and I get that, and I'm like that too, because I go, I know what it's like when I'm having a bad day and I'm trying and I'm juggling and trying to make sure everybody gets good care. I've been there. So yes, there's always an element of that in the NHS, all day, every day. But there is also a conception about the kind of illness that hyperemesis gravidarum is, the kind of women that are affected.
What is that?
That women are malingerers, that they have psychological issues, that it's their way of expressing that they don't want to be pregnant, that they just can't cope with being pregnant and they just need to get on with it and stop complaining.
And have you heard this? Have you heard these views being expressed?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, very much so. It made me angry before I got pregnant. And even when I was in hospital, I mean, my cannula fell out, which is the instrument that's used into a vein to give fluids. And someone was told, well, you can only have it back if you need it.
You're kidding.
I was like, well, why wouldn't I need it? I can't keep food or fluids down. And I wasn't that polite when I said it.
Good.
But there is definitely a preconception about hyperemesis, and that means women are starting on the back foot. Mm. When you're already vulnerable, you're having to fight. And I hear, and there's a charity called Pregnancy Sickness Support, which is absolutely amazing, and they hear all sorts from women about the things that they've been told by medical professionals. And it's such a shame, because whilst drugs aren't always the magical cure, what can make a difference is compassion and kindness, and that doesn't cost anything.
No. Do you think then that it's just an area of women's health that needs more research and more time dedicated to it?
Absolutely, yeah. And there was some research published, I think it was 2017, which was one of the first research articles that showed a possible gene that causes hyperemesis.
Wow.
And one of the biggest things that would change preconceptions is if a cause were found. So yeah. And that's a shame, because we should believe women without there having to be a specific gene. But if there is a gene, then there's hope for therapies that can help cure this.
Yeah.
So there are new developments, and that's fascinating to think that they might be able to find a reason behind it and therefore find a way to make it easier.
And do you think that, obviously, you know, doing the job that you do, are you aware that in general less research has been done over the years, you know, into women's health issues and conditions?
I think that's true. I think that women's health is neglected is the wrong word, probably not as invested in as highly as other things. Talk to a woman with endometriosis and she'll tell you how long it took her to get diagnosed.
Yep, I'm there. I've put my hands in the air.
Yeah.
Took me years to be diagnosed. Yeah. And I know so many women with a similar story.
Yeah, and the stories are really similar, and it's heartbreaking because there's a spectrum of endometriosis and it affects women differently. Mm. But something I hear a lot is how long they had symptoms for.
Yeah. Yeah,
And I wonder if that would happen if it affected a different population.
Which is so frustrating that, you know, women do have to have that many conversations, that many doctor's appointments, you know, to be kind of sent off with, you know, misdiagnosis or and be suffering and, you know, in pain or discomfort just because of that.
Yeah. So I think we're talking about it more, and that's always a good thing. And again, it's somewhere where bias comes in, and we need to unpack that and think, why are we not taking women seriously? Because a psychologist once upon a time said that women with abdominal pain were hysterical.
Mm.
You know, can we not move beyond that? It's 2019.
Yeah.
And I know it's deeper than that. There will be people listening going, well, that's an oversimplification. Yes, it is, because it's a podcast and I'm not a researcher. But yeah, we need to move forwards.
Absolutely. So going back to your how you were feeling during pregnancy, you described that your husband would have to, you know, help you up down the stairs. Mm-hmm. What kind of support was he giving you? It must have been really hard for him to watch you. I mean, not as hard as it was for you, don't get me wrong.
Wow.
But but what kind of support was, you know, were you getting from him or from your family around you?
It was just an unwavering sense that they were always there and that they didn't judge me and that they didn't expect too much or ask me to be what I couldn't be, because what I couldn't be was ecstatically happy about being pregnant all the time, which is what I wanted more than anything. I was so excited. And actually, some of my posts from when I first got pregnant are still on my account, and you can go back and see where I'm like, and now I've got vitamins, and now I got this, before I got sick.
It was an anonymous account then.
It was, yeah.
So you were obviously being quite open very early about your pregnancy.
Yeah, because I felt like I could be, because, you know, it was just for me. So yeah. It was a bit like a diary.
Yeah.
So my husband was amazing. He used to, once I went back to work, I couldn't go in the kitchen and I couldn't go in the fridge because of smells and things. So he used to make my lunch for me every day, just make a little packed lunch for me. And he used to come to my hospital appointments and never put any pressure on me, I guess, and was just... High premise isn't nice at the best of times. Having someone being sick all the time and saying, well, no, I don't want to eat that, and no, I don't want to go there, and can you not wear that aftershave? And I've thrown all the cleaning things in the bin because they smell and they remind me of being pregnant. And that, I mean, that's now.
Yeah,
being talking.
Yeah, I'll bet. Are there still things that you smell or things that you do that immediately take you back to that time?
Yep, can't eat mini cheddars.
Oh, I'm the same. I didn't have high premises, but just from normal morning sickness,
yeah.
I ate mini cheddars loads,
yep,
because it was like the only thing that it was like bland, carby, and now can't touch them.
So yeah, that's that product placement ad I was going to get is never going to come now.
Damn it.
So no mini cheddars. There's brand new yogurt I can't eat. There's some lavender cleaning things that I can't go anywhere near. So those things are quite triggering. But just even if I feel a bit nauseous because I think maybe I've eaten something, automatically all the feelings come flooding back.
Wow.
And that has implications for, you know, I would have loved to, I always said to my husband, I'm going to have four kids. I mean, he shriveled up in a corner and cried at that point. But I would have loved a big family. It has an impact on that. I would have liked to have children close together. It's had an impact on that. It just affects a lot more than I assumed it would at the time.
It's crazy, isn't it? Because you do think, oh, well, you know, it's only a few weeks. And once you're through it, you're through it. And, you know, when you have the baby, you know, it's worth it in the end.
And you're just so grateful to be pregnant. And as long as the baby's okay.
That frustrates me, that as long as the baby is okay thing, because actually it's kind of like devaluing you and your feelings and your experience.
Absolutely. And it means that you're just a vessel for a child, because if, as long as the baby's okay, that's fine, then it doesn't matter what happens to you, surely. So why are you complaining? And I hear women saying that a lot at work, and coming from the best place possible. And what they mean is, please look after my baby.
Of course.
And of course you say that because you're scared and you're vulnerable. And I always say to them, my job is to look after you and the baby.
Yeah.
And if I focus on you right now, then you can continue to focus on the baby.
Yeah.
Because that's all they want to do. But women are not vessels for having babies. Some women never have babies. Some women never want to. Some women can't. They are no less women than anybody else.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that makes me mad.
Yep. No, I'm with you. I'm with you there. And do you think that, in terms of like the long-term effects that this has had for you, do you think that that's something that will fade? Do you think that feeling, I mean, I guess you don't know. It's like asking you to look into the future and you know, predict what's going to happen. I guess all you can do is hope that those feelings will fade.
I hope so, but when I think about other traumatic things I've been through through my life, and I won't expand too much because that's for my autobiography after I win Strictly. But
I love it. That's planning for you.
Absolutely. Dream big. But when I think about other traumatic events in my life and they're not sharp and the memories are more blunt... And with high premises, while some of it has faded, I can still remember a lot more of it than I want to.
Mm.
And I think I will always remember. And when I talk to women who are in their 60s or 70s, for example, who had high premises, they can talk about it like it was yesterday.
Wow. Do you think that it's something that, you know, you should almost be going to therapy to be dealing with all of this?
I think for some women, absolutely, therapy is really important. And I think if you need to, then you should do that. I'm quite lucky that I can talk to my family about it. I have a couple of friends who have had high premises who now have children who I can talk to about it.
Mm.
I'm quite open about if I'm having a bad day. I guess that's a way that social media is good.
Yeah.
Where I can go, I feel really nauseous today, and it's all come back. And it sounds a bit melodramatic almost to go, I feel nauseous today and now I want to, you know, hide in bed because it reminds me of how bad I felt.
Yeah.
But I know there are other people that feel like that.
Yeah, and not even just with hyperemesis. I mean, I spoke on social media maybe 2 years ago about walking into Tesco and seeing a brand of baby food that I had fed my daughter years earlier. And it totally triggering me and taking me back to that kind of early period where, you know, she was just weaning and I was obviously in, you know, the depths of PND, and just seeing that on the shelf instantly took me back.
The flashback and just the memories and associations are so strong. I think for trauma, whatever package trauma comes, recognizing that and the impact it can have, and it taking you by surprise, because it often does take you by surprise, and it's horrible.
It throws you, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and it kind of almost like throws you off kilter for the rest of the day, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think you're right. That's where going onto social media and talking about it can really help, because it helps you process it, but also other people might be a bit like, oh, that's happened to me.
Yeah.
And then you start this conversation, which is helping everybody.
Yeah, I've got this network of women who contacted me when I had hyperemesis, and they were not talking to me as a doctor. They were talking to me as, I'm a woman who's had hyperemesis or is going through it too. And our kids are now the same ages. You know, there's someone in Croatia, there's someone in Australia, there are people in the US. And they're just women that were like, you know, we're here to listen, or I know what it's like. And that was really nice.
Now, the first time that I ever came across hyperemesis was when Kate Middleton had it.
Yeah, that's the same for a lot of people.
Do you think that that was a blessing because it suddenly put it into the public eye and people knew about it and learned about it? Or has it been a bit of a curse in that people almost dismiss it as being, oh, well, Kate Middleton had that and it's just bad morning sickness and she was fine, therefore you'll be fine too?
Yeah, I think both. It's accessible for a lot of people. So if you can say, well, that's what, you know, the Duchess of Cambridge had, and then people can go, oh, yeah, okay, I know a bit more about it now. But then they also go, oh, well, it can't have been that bad because, you know, she had all that staff and she's got three kids, so it can't have been that bad.
Yeah.
But then you go, remember that she missed her oldest son's first day of school because she felt so sick. How many mums would do that just because? And she hasn't spoken about it herself, and I don't think she should ever feel under any obligation to, because we don't know how she dealt with the trauma. We don't know how it's affected her. So, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. Well, I think you talking about it today will have helped lots of people. So thank you very much for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Big respect to Rhea for getting through that experience. It does not sound pleasant at all, does it? Thank you for joining me today. Please subscribe to the podcast and rate and review, because it really helps other people find the podcast. And I shall catch up with you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.